It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. When it comes to racial disparities and criminal justice, Wisconsin stands out. The state has the highest rate of black male incarceration in the country at double the national average. And Wisconsin is the worst state in the country to be a black child, according to the National Race to Results Study, looking at things like education and income. And in Milwaukee, the situation is even more striking. It has the highest degree of racial segregation and black poverty in the nation. Half of all 30 to 40-year-old black men living in Milwaukee County have been incarcerated. While these numbers aren't new, recent protests around the nation have put them into greater focus. This week, members of the Milwaukee community gathered at Clinton Row Senior Center to talk about race and criminal justice. Mayor Tom Barrett spoke, as well as Chief Judge Jeffrey Kramers. State Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee was also there and spoke from the crowd. She joins us now to talk about the racial issues facing the state and Milwaukee. Senator Taylor, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be with you.
Well, what was the scene like at the Senior Center on Wednesday?
Well, you know, I always love going to the Community Justice Council, but this was one of the largest turnouts that there's ever been since the council was created. In addition, one of the more diverse turnouts, because often early on there was often individuals from the system, meaning people who work in the system or are elected, you know, but not community. And so there was a huge, compared to previously, number of individuals who've come from the community, as well as there was also diversity in age as well as in race. And so that was very encouraging.
Why was the turnout so big at this particular meeting?
I think, one, because of the topic. They were talking about race in the justice system. Many of us did social media work and advertisement to get individuals out and engaged, as well as, I think, just the whole environment of what's happening across the nation in regards to race and the justice system, because the justice system encompasses everything from policing to district attorneys to judges and to the services and availability of defense representation, as well as services for things that people need in our system across the board. And the disparities that exist across that are the, you know, challenges in the nation. And so I think people were excited to be able to hear, well, what's going on? Are we going to hear some truths? And there were some real encouraging things that I think happened in the room, like learning that for the first time across our entire justice system, they shut it down to have a conversation about race, and that they did that for what was equivalent to an entire workday, that someone did a presentation for them where they talked about everything from, you know, white privilege to the preconceived notions that we might have when we're walking down the street and we, you know, hear somebody walking behind us.
Well, the racial issues that Milwaukee deals with on a regular basis, they're in the national spotlight now, as you said, against a backdrop of Ferguson and national protests. How is that affecting dialogue in Milwaukee?
We had some for the first time that I can recall. What they did at Clinton Row Center, what the Community Justice Council did. Now, granted, I feel that there were many challenges in what they did. You know, we shouldn't have the chief judge, who's Caucasian, facilitating a conversation about race. It's important for him to share what happened among the judges and the DAs. I think that that's important. But I don't think that that would have necessarily been the best facilitator. And I think that when you are having a conversation with the community, it can't be a monologue. You know, you can't hear someone give a comment and then try to tell them why what they said isn't it, or why they should, you know, feel comfortable because we did a little bit, you know, on the issue. So I think that and I think you have to have people of color engaged in the preparation and in the presentation of what you do if you want to talk about race. It doesn't look right if you just have, you know, all white guys.
Now, at one point, as I understand it, Mayor Barrett said sometimes he's actually embarrassed to be the mayor of Milwaukee when he's looking at the data on racial disparities. That was a striking thing for a mayor to admit. What did you think when you heard him say that?
I was glad to hear him say that. I think that it's no different than the conversation that we had with the governor when he first got elected as the Black Caucus. We met with him and said, we have some of the worst disparities that exist in the nation. I don't care if you're Democrat or Republican. Governor or a citizen. We shouldn't be proud to be the cesspool of, you know, the worst. And so I'm glad to know that it makes the mayor uncomfortable, and that because of that, he was willing to be a part of a conversation to talk about race in the justice system. I was glad that he went to sit with the president to have a conversation about what can be done, you know, differently in midst of policing to help to rebuild the trust that is broken among our police department and our community. So, you know, it's refreshing for me to hear someone speak the truth, right? Now let's do something about it.
Well,
it's
coming out of this,
little bitty bits and pieces.
Coming out of this now, do you leave with the sense that people are committed to taking concrete action to get to work on some of these racial inequities?
Oh, I want to be clear. I know that people have been doing some work on justice reform issues. Much of the work that the Community Justice Council is doing is work that came from years and years of work that many people have done, including the State of the Justice Tour that we did in 2007, and 2009, the justice reinvestment work that came from the great work of the Justice Center, which is part of the Council of State Government. So many people who came from that committee then came and brought that work in Milwaukee County, and they've been tweaking and doing that work since then. So they've been doing the work. The issue is that we have to be transformational, and we are going to need to do it at a larger scale, so it's going to require more collaboration across not just you know, some individuals in the justice system, but across the city, the county, and the state working together, right, in order to create some changes in policy as well as services. You know, all of that has to happen simultaneously in order for us not to lead in the nation in incarceration of African American men. I mean, that's, you know, it is you know, more than twice. I think we're at almost 13% or something like that of our population, which is more than twice the national average, I think.
Now, you use the word transformational about what you need to do moving forward in Milwaukee. What would that look like, and what kind of time frame are you hoping for?
Candidly, a lot of the work is being done, but we're in silos. So I kind of want to break down the walls on the silos and create a bowling alley, and we could hit some strikes real quickly. For example, we already know that mental health and alcohol and drug addiction, which I think is mental health, those issues are, a number one, a trigger for why we're in the situation we are. And our community correction system is another. So there's been a lot of work that's been done, but on a smaller, like, pilot, like, smaller pieces. And it's time to ramp those things up. And so I think we have to create opportunities for larger collaborations to happen so that we're, for example, not doing a program on reentry and helping people get job training that's for 25 people when we know in the community that we're doing it in, they have 3,000 people who reenter.
Now,
we've got to ramp those kind of programs up. That's what I envision.
Do you think that the state needs to be involved? And on a state level,
yes.
Right now, is there the sense that the state government is also invested in making changes?
Most definitely, the state has to be involved. And surely, part of the reason that we're where we are is because of the horrific policies like truth and sentencing that created these horrific over-incarceration numbers, the disparities that existed, you know, in the difference of policing for various drug charges, how we have an over-incarceration of nonviolent offenders, which is one of the triggers that we learned in 2009 from the state, Wisconsin state data that we learned was one of our issues. Well, our governor, honestly, to be very candid, led the charge on a lot of that legislation in our state, the truth in sentencing in particular legislation. But I think because of his interest to run for governor, I mean president, as well as I think having a budget that was the number one spender in corrections, that it's even caused someone like him to look at things differently. And I candidly know that I have colleagues on the other side of the aisle. I know Representative Hutton in particular has been a champion on looking into the issues of the correction system and how we can do things differently so that we're not a leader in a negative way. And I believe that the governor is more interested now, for whatever reason that he's interested. I'm glad. And I'm willing to lock arms with Democrat, Republican, male, female, old, young, white, black, Hispanic, you name it, Hmong, who's willing to work on these issues.
Now, taking this to a national level for a moment, with regards to criminal justice, some protesters are calling for police video cameras to hold police to greater account. And in New York, Eric Garner's death was captured on video camera, but there was no indictment. Do you feel that video cameras are part of the solution?
There is no question that video cameras create transparency, and transparency always helps things to be different, and I think move in a positive direction. So, yes, I believe the video cameras are part of the solution. Do I believe that they're the panacea? No. Do I believe that, because we have a camera that it means that the justice system, the over-policing, the district attorney's discretion or the judge's discretion are now all of a sudden going to be perfect? No, of course not. And do I believe that if we're talking about we're gonna have video cameras, but we're only going to have 15, 20, 50 of them on a police force that has hundreds or a thousand plus people, then that's not going to be very effective, right, unless you figure out how you're going to target with those few that you have to make a difference. So, yes, they're a part of the solution, but it has to be real. It can't be just to say you did it, but you really didn't do enough for it to even make a dent. And then with the cameras, you need to use the cameras then also to determine what preventive measures you can put into place or tracking measures you can put into place so that we don't get to the Mike Browns or the Derek Williams, like the gentleman in Milwaukee who died in the back of a police car gasping for breath and saying he couldn't breathe, or Dontre Hamilton, the young man who had mental health challenges and was in a park sleeping. The officer shot him 14 times. So those situations not only require that we track and see if someone has an excessive force, complaint, but that we also have mandatory training for police in areas like cultural competency, in areas like how to deal with individuals with mental health issues, list goes on.
And briefly, on a personal level, you're a state senator representing a region with some of the worst outcomes for African Americans in the country. What are your hopes, your dearest hopes, going forward for Milwaukee?
You said it best right there, that I would be able to say that when I came, those are the kind of stats that we had. And when I left, that those stats are not the stats that we have. And because of the policy and the work that I've done, that we are not number one in the nation in incarceration of African American men. That 56% unemployment in Milwaukee is no longer so, that we were able to address that. That, 37% of African American women and 29% of African American women who are in poverty are no longer there. That 85% of the children in Milwaukee not being able to read on grade level is no longer the truth. Instead, it's flipped around. Oh, it's only 15% of the children who can't read on grade level. I'd like it to be zero, but my point is 85% not being able to read is only the pipeline to this very conversation, that we speak to. If you don't have hope, if you can't see hope, if you can't read, you can't learn. If you can't learn, you can't work. So it's all interconnected. It would be my dream that correction reform would happen so that we would have different outcomes.
Senator Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with State Senator Lena Taylor from Milwaukee about racial disparities in the state. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Have you ever finished reading a story or watching a movie or a TV series and been left wanting more? Or maybe you wanted a different ending? Well, those are pretty common feelings, but some devoted fans take matters into their own hands. That's where fan fiction comes in. It's a term used to describe any literary work written by fans about certain stories, characters, or settings and not the original creators. Fan fiction used to be on the fringe of the literary world, but some recent examples of fan fiction are hitting the big time. The hit trilogy 50 Shades of Grey, for instance, got its start as fan fiction. And the new series After, based on the boy band One Direction, made the jump from fan fiction to published book. It hit the shelves this month. So just how popular is fan fiction these days, and who are the people writing it and reading it? Joining us is Anne Jamison. She's an associate professor of English at the University of Utah, where she teaches a class on fan fiction. She's also the author of Fic, Why Fan Fiction is Taking Over the World. We'll also hear from a regional fan fiction author later in the program. Anne, thanks so much for being here today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I just tried to give a little overview there of what fan fiction is, but for people who are just being introduced to this notion, give us a sense of what it's all about.
Well, I think you described it very well. I think today a big part of most fan fiction writers and readers' experience is that it happens online. And that hasn't always been the case, but the rise of the internet has led it to become much more interconnected. It's easier to find. It's easier to find fans that are doing it, and it's easier for it to spread, I think. Say I just finished watching Merlin, and I'm thinking, wow, they're never making any more of that show. I love that show. I want to see some more stories about it. So you just Google Merlin fan fiction, and, you know, you will find some, and then usually it takes some digging. But you'll eventually find something most likely that you'll want to read.
How widespread is it?
Sorry?
How widespread is it today?
It's very widespread. It is so widespread that it is sort of astonishing that it took so long for it to come, you know, sort of to the public consciousness. I mean, it is global. If you post your stories on fanfiction.net or even on Wattpad, you will find that you have readers all over the world. You don't necessarily know who they are, but you know where they're checking in from. So it's vast, it's global. Nobody really knows quite how much because there aren't any good statistics. There's not a lot of good research on it. But once you start, you know, having millions or even hundreds of millions of clicks on a story, you know there's a lot of people reading.
Well, what do we know about who's actually writing this stuff?
We know that they are predominantly women, although that varies depending on what the source material is. You'll find more men writing My Little Pony fan fiction, for example. You'll find more men traditionally writing in Star Wars or Lord of the Rings. But for a long time now, fan fiction has been predominantly women, and it is women, despite some stereotypes, it is women of all ages. In my book, I think the youngest author that I had was 16, and the oldest one was old enough to have been one of the early Star Trek writers in the 60s. So I know people of all ages.
I don't know enough, I guess, to know what the stereotypes are. What is the stereotype of a fan fiction writer?
Well, you get a lot of people saying that it's teen girls, which it certainly can be. There's a lot of teen girls writing fan fiction. Then you also get the sort of stereotype of, you know, I don't know, sex-crazed shut-ins. I'd say those are the two most prominent. Generally, the idea is like people who don't have real skills or people don't have social skills or somehow, you know, they have to turn to this desperate form. That's something that you'll see, you know, repeated again and again in media stories on fan fiction, both of those stereotypes. And that's just very far from the case. I mean, not that there aren't people that meet those stereotypes, but there are plenty of people. I mean, I know a lot of professors who are writing it. I know a lot of lawyers who are writing it. Many, many, many housewives write it. It varies so much.
It seems like the biggest example of fan fiction that's gone mainstream, become a hit, becoming a movie, is 50 Shades of Grey. And a lot of people still don't know that that actually began as fan fiction about Twilight, right?
Oh, sure. It didn't just begin as fan fiction. The published version is 89% identical to what was posted as fan fiction. She literally changed the names.
Wow.
A couple of locations. So, I mean, it was, the relationship between 50 Shades of Grey, or what was then called Master of the Universe, was pretty tenuous, and that was pretty typical of the Twilight fandom. A lot of you know, it almost started seeing the Twilight novels as a kind of loose story prompt where you had some structures in place and a few sort of character types. And then it turned out there was just an endless number of stories that you could tell based on that. And they would borrow from each other. So you'll find things in 50 Shades of Grey that if you knew the stories that were being written around that time, you'll recognize parts of 50 Shades of Grey as coming from other fan fiction stories, which caused no little controversy at the time, I can tell you.
Well, from what I've seen, there's a good deal of fan fiction that seems to take a turn toward the erotic. And, of course, 50 Shades of Grey is all about that. Do you think that this is true, that maybe there is an overemphasis, or at least a big emphasis, on eroticism in fan fiction? And does that hurt the perception of fan fiction?
Well, you know, any time when women are acting as something other than sexual objects in a sexual context, it makes people very nervous. So I think, yes, I mean, the fact that there is erotica written by and for women that's very popular, that sometimes doesn't even include any women in the erotic scenes, people don't know what to do with that, because that's not typically how our culture presents women in a sexual context. But I don't want to suggest that there's not a lot of fan fiction written about erotic scenarios, because there is. It's a huge part of it. But it's not the majority part of it. It's just the part that gets most attention. And, you know, in writing about it, I have to confess, it's a lot of times the part that is the most interesting to me, because, a little adventure story written by, you know, a 12-year-old is very nice, but as a college professor, there's less than I can do with that. And even the kind of fan fiction that I've liked to write myself, which is pretty tame and pretty much just, it's fun for me to get as close as possible to the voices of the characters that I didn't write. Like, that's fun for a writer. I wouldn't have that much to say about it, except that was a good job, or that's not so good. Doesn't sound anything like Buffy. You know, so I think that there's much more attention paid to the erotica, because that's where something really different is happening in the erotica than is happening anywhere else.
Well, we're talking right now about the world of fan fiction with Ann Jameson, and you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you write or read fan fiction? What got you into it, and what do you think the appeal is? Call 800-642-1234. We'll pick up this conversation and hear from a regional fan fiction writer after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. We're talking about the world of fan fiction, what it is, who's writing it and reading it, and where it's seeing mainstream success. 50 Shades of Grey is fan fiction. So is a series called After, featuring the boy band One Direction. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. Ann Jameson, professor of English at the University of Utah, stays with us. And we're also going to welcome in now Tanya DePass. She's a Chicago-based fan fiction writer and serves on the convention planning committee for WisCon, a feminist science fiction convention that takes place each May in Madison. Tanya, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
So tell us, what kind of fan fiction do you write?
Right now, I'm mostly writing things based in the Dragon Age fandom, which is a RPG fantasy setting video game. It's anything from general kind of fluff pieces, if I take requests, up to more adult-themed writing.
How'd you get into that?
I actually started writing fan fiction many, many years ago when I was kind of a teenager with not much idea of how things worked in the world and wanted to be creative. And, you know, I always loved to write, and it was just something that let me play in a sandbox that was already there, but play around with characters that have been created that are already well-loved and that I was able to find something to click with.
Can you tell us about your audience a little bit? Do you get to know them much, and are they who you're writing for?
I've actually made a lot of great friends through fan fiction, through people who either like the same pairings I do, or as some people call them, ships or relationships. And for the most part, I'm writing for myself, which sounds a little bit selfish, but, you know, I write what I write because I enjoy it. But I do take requests. A lot of times I'll participate in fandom challenges where you're given a prompt and a pairing and you have to kind of make it work, or you take an anonymous prompt and write something for someone and then you exchange it as a gift.
Now, you've been in fan fiction for a while, since you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Has the landscape of it changed a lot while you've been writing over the years?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's fanfiction.net. Now there's Archive of Our Own. There's adultfanfiction.net. There's a lot of places where you previously could put anything you wanted out there, but now things have changed where fanfiction.net is now a little bit more family-friendly. They really crack down on ratings and the content, versus Archive of Our Own really belongs to the fans, and, you know, it's supported by the fans, run by the fans.
And is there sort of more of a back and forth with fan fiction writers and readers, that they influence the story more than, say, you know, George R. R. Martin might not listen to people who write him and say, hey, take the direction this way with some of your characters? Is there more overlap when you're writing fan fiction?
There is, and sometimes it's not always an equivalent exchange. Because when you post something online, it's out there, and whether or not you want critique, ask for critique, or commentary, once you put it out there, you're going to get that critique. If it's something where I'm working with someone, because I do sometimes co-write with a friend, we do a lot of give and take, or I may post a snippet and say, I'm stuck with this idea, does anyone have an idea? If you were writing this, what would you do? But then there is the unhappy side of it, where you can finish something, you're happy with it, it's something you wrote on a whim, and someone will come along and go, I don't like how you wrote this character. You should really rewrite it, which I've actually had happen. You know, something's been done for months, and I'll get a comment of, well, you know, this characterization is off. You should really redo this. And it's like, well, the story's been finished for months. That's not going to happen. I'm sorry.
Well, you're very open, obviously, about writing fan fiction. Mm-hmm. Do you think that most people are? Is it acceptable to be out there as a fan fiction writer?
I don't think it is. I think it really depends on your friends. I mean, I'm a big gaming nerd, and that's my thing, and I'm pretty much out there with it. But I don't think a lot of people really are open with writing fan fiction. Yes, Twilight and Fifty Shades of Grey are changing that, but there's still this kind of titillation of like, oh, you do that thing. You write fanfic, and you do that thing with those characters that aren't yours. So I don't think it's as open as it could be.
And any advice for people who hear this and think, you know, this sounds like a lot of fun? What about advice for would-be writers?
You know, take a character you love. Take a character you identify with. Pick a scenario that doesn't happen either in canon, or maybe you've watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and you really want this character to get together with another character, but it's not canon. Just sit down and write it. Even if you just write it for yourself, it's a blog post you write and hide and no one else sees. It's something that you've done and produced. You've fulfilled that creative void that was placed there by the show, or you're talking with someone and they go, hey, I really like this character, but they don't get enough exposure. You could write something where they have a lot more exposure. They get to be the hero. You know, don't let limitations stop you. Don't let people tell you, oh, that's silly, don't do it. Just, if you want to be creative, just go do it.
Now, before we let you go, let's find out a little more about WisCon. What is that and what do you do there?
So this is my fifth year attending WisCon, or it will be next year for WisCon 39. It is a feminist sci-fi convention held every year in Madison, Wisconsin. So your listeners are all in Wisconsin, hopefully, and they can attend. And it's a great 3-4 days of panels about intersectionality, about feminism, about writing. There are a lot of professional authors who come. There's great guests of honor. It's a lot of fun, and it's very educational. And there is an academic track for any academics listening. You know, it's a very good space for someone who either wants to learn or has an idea about intersectionality and feminism and has thoughts about it and wants to be on a panel. This isn't you need a doctorate in, you know, gender studies to be on a panel. If you've watched 10 episodes of Sleepy Hollow, go be on a panel on Sleepy Hollow. You know, it's a lot of fun. It's a very good value. It's only $50 pre-registration. And you will make a lot of friends there. You will meet people that are like-minded and get to know other folks that have the same interests, and it really builds a community.
Well, Tanya, thanks a lot for coming on and talking fan fiction.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to do so.
We've been speaking to Chicago-based fan fiction writer Tanya DePass, and now we bring back Ann Jamison into the conversation. She's an associate professor of English at the University of Utah, and she teaches a class there on fan fiction. And Ann, Tanya was referring to the feeling that some fan fiction writers are a little bit embarrassed about it. They don't want to be out in the open. Is there a stigma associated with this, and is that changing?
I do think it's changing, but it's certainly true that there's a big stigma attached to it, or, you know, there has been in the past. I mean, as it's gone a little bit more mainstream, you get more and more published writers sort of coming out and saying, yeah, I started this way. That story gets more traction. And as soon as somebody's making money from something, you know, we tend to, as a culture, value it more. I think that still, though, I mean, when I was looking for contributors for my book, I mean, I had a number of people say that even if they were going to publish under their fan names, they were really nervous that they would face repercussions at work, or they wouldn't be taken seriously if it came out that they were writing fan fiction. It sounds silly to some people, despite the fact that, you know, you have a Star Trek reboot, which is essentially works very much that way, or all of the Marvel universe that keeps reinventing itself. I mean, all of those people are only ever writing about other people's characters, but it's in an economy that is not volunteer, that is not gift-based, and so we treat that differently.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got a call from Rachel, and you can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us whether you like fan fiction. Do you read it or you write it? Are you intrigued by the possibilities that it offers you to play with these characters that you love and you're interested in? 800-642-1234. And Rachel from West Bend joins us now. Hey, Rachel.
Hi. I'm an avid reader of fan fiction, all different genres, and, you know, it's a chance, I think, for people to write the characters of how they see them and kind of explore ideas that, you know, might not have been allowed on the TV show or the movie or the game to be explored. So it gives people a chance to kind of see how maybe characters would interplay with each other, you know, that might not have actually happened or people would want to happen. I know the Elbert in the past, when it was going, had a fan fiction contest that would eventually be made into an episode. And so fan fiction writers could create the episode themselves and write the characters the way that they wanted to see them play out.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your thoughts, Rachel. And Rachel and Tanya both describing fan fiction as sort of almost like a sandbox that they can play in and just try different things. They love the universe that's already been created. They love the characters. And now they just get to create.
Sure. And sometimes you find, you know, it's not out of love. Sometimes it's out of, you know, extreme anguish or rage, even that, you know, the show, if you're watching a serialized or reading a serialized piece, and the writers take it in a direction that, you know, killed off somebody that you've come to love, or, you know, broke up the relationship you were invested in. You see people coming in droves, you know, to write fan fiction to fix it, you know, to get the story that they wanted, or something that I'm very interested in. Say, you know, for example, you know, there are people on the autism spectrum sometimes identify with the character of Sherlock in the BBC Sherlock. And, you know, they will write stories that sort of accentuate his characteristics that might, you know, that they identify with. And so they end up having a character somehow in this mainstream cultural position, maybe having, you know, having this brilliant friendship, or maybe having erotic adventures or whatever, in a way isn't ever given a chance in an actual show. You don't see that kind of a character.
Well, thanks a lot to Rachel for the call. Let's go to another from Sean in Waukesha. Hi, Sean.
Hi there. I have just a quick question for your guest here. I know fan fiction comes in a wide variety of qualities, and I'm wondering if you've heard of anything that's kind of acquired a reputation of almost being better quality than the universe or the fandom in which it's drawn from.
Okay, good question, Sean.
Well, sure. I mean, you hear that all the time about different, different universes. It depends a lot on taste and what you call good. But I certainly, I mean, what really got me interested in writing about fan fiction in a more serious way was when I began to read fan fiction for Twilight, which I hadn't read. And the fan fiction was better than I thought Twilight would be. And then I went and looked at Twilight, and it actually, I mean, it just in terms of the writing and sort of the literary quality of the writing of some of these stories was much better than what I saw in Twilight, although Twilight, I think, has obviously affected a lot of people in a way that it means I wouldn't call it bad. It's not the kind of writing that I particularly like, and some of it was. And I've seen that in a number of cases where, yeah, the source maybe isn't even written, like in the case of some of the One Direction fan fictions. And One Direction is not a band that I particularly love, but I've seen people do some really interesting things in the fan fiction. So, yeah, that happens all the time.
Do you have a sense how the creators of the original, you know, TV show, book, movie, whatever, feel about people writing fan fiction?
You know, it varies. Some people absolutely hate it. George R.R. Martin, that you brought up, is very much opposed to it. Anne Rice has famously been opposed. And then, you know, somebody like Joss Whedon is just all in favor and, you know, used to encourage people, yeah, well, you didn't like that ending? Well, you know, write a fanfic, you know, make it yours. I think a lot of writers are increasingly seeing it as it's very flattering if somebody likes their characters enough to want to write about them. That feels good to some writers, not to all. I think, you know, for some of the real people, you know, the celebrities that get written about, some of them find it flattering, and then I think some of them find it very strange that people are imagining lives for them. I mean, I don't know what they thought was happening before people started writing it down. I mean, that's what people do. They imagine lives for celebrities. But I think there is something that changes when it gets written down.
Anne, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Anne Jamison. She's an associate professor of English at the University of Utah, where she teaches a class on fan fiction. She's also the author of Fic, Why Fan Fiction is Taking Over the World. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's time for our weekly check-in on what's making news in Wisconsin, including talk of right-to-work legislation as well as future transportation projects in the state. WPR's news director Michael Leland joins us now. Michael, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Right-to-work legislation is making news in Wisconsin. It's been a big story this week. What do we know so far?
Yeah, a few developments. It looks like it will be on the legislature's agenda next year, and that's because of a number of things that happened this week. On Monday, a conservative activist named Lori Pickens announced that a new group had been formed. It's called Wisconsin Right to Work, and it had been formed to advocate for such a law. A little bit of background. Right to Work is on the books right now in 24 states, and what it does is ban mandatory union shops in the private sector, essentially saying that a person can't be required to join a union as a condition of their employment.
It's an interesting thing because the governor is not the one advocating for this right now, it seems to be. What has he said so far about how he feels about right to work?
Right. His public statements have not been encouraging for those who want to see this pass. What he said this week is that he hopes the legislature instead next year will focus on his agenda rather than trying to pass right to work. That agenda, of course, includes reforming taxes, education, regulations, and entitlements. The governor says that pursuing right to work at this time would be a distraction, although he didn't say that he would veto such a bill if it happened to wind up on his desk.
How are Republicans in the legislature planning to move forward so far?
There is a movement already. On Tuesday this week, Republican State Representative Chris Kapinga of Delafield said that he would introduce right-to-work legislation in the new session. And then yesterday, Republican leader of the state Senate, Scott Fitzgerald, said there was no way to avoid dealing with right-to-work legislation. He said Republicans would consider exempting some private workers from this, like operators of earth movers. Those workers have largely supported Republicans in the past, but Republicans say that this exemption would be because these workers train others in their industry, not because of any political support. So it looks like there is some momentum to this, even though the governor is saying this could be a distraction. It seems that at least the Republican leadership in the Assembly is willing to take that chance.
All right, this is one we'll be watching closely. Now, another discussion happening in the state this week, public benefits, and this is, again, something the legislature is looking at. What do we know about where that's going?
Right. Also likely to be taken up in the new session, which begins in January. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss this week said that a new public benefit reform committee has been created. He says that lawmakers need to weed out fraud, waste, and abuse and make sure that people who really need temporary assistance are getting it.
Now, drug testing has been part of this whole conversation for a while. What's the status of that?
Right. Voss has said the legislature will consider a bill that would require drug testing for all people who are receiving public benefits. The Assembly's agenda this next year calls for encouraging all public benefits programs to also be administered through an electronic debit card. That card would be programmed in a way that they couldn't be used in places like casinos or liquor stores or strip clubs. Now, as far as the drug testing goes, there has been some polling done that suggests that the public largely supports it, although there's also some evidence that it might not be legal. Federal courts have found it unconstitutional in other parts of the country, namely Florida, where also when the idea was tried there, it actually cost the state more money than it saved because so few people actually tested positive for drugs among public aid recipients that actual drug testing cost more than they saved in denying benefits.
And the next session starts in 3 weeks, so.
Yes. So it's going to be a busy January up in the Capitol.
So moving to the national scene, Wisconsin joined a lawsuit suing the Obama administration. What do we know about that case?
Yeah, Wisconsin joined 16 other states in a lawsuit to stop the president's executive order on immigration. You probably remember that a couple of weeks ago, the president announced an executive order that would shield more than 4 million people who are in the U.S. illegally from deportation. Now, Republicans in Congress have said that this order pretty much kills any prospect of passing immigration reform and probably damages any prospect of cooperation over the next couple of years with the president.
And in terms of Governor Walker and how this could proceed, what do we know there?
Yeah, the governor requested that State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen join the lawsuit. The state of Texas is the state that's taking the lead on this case. Now, Walker is saying that this is not about immigration. He says it's really about stopping what he and many other Republicans see as an abuse of power by the president. Walker says Obama has gone, what he says, is beyond the rule of law in this case.
And in terms of what the lawsuit itself says, what do we know about the language?
Yeah, it says that the president protected millions of immigrants from deportation, and in doing so, he violated the U.S. Constitution by rewriting laws that were passed by Congress under the guise of what's called executive discretion. And that basically gives the president the power to act in matters where Congress hasn't passed a specific law addressing those matters. The president has said all along, if you want immigration reform, pass a bill. That hasn't happened yet. Republicans now say the president has gone too far. And again, they say that, you know, any thoughts of immigration reform is severely damaged at this point. So a lot more to come on this.
Right. Another to be continued. And I guess one question would be whether any more states will join the suit. Something else to watch.
Exactly.
Well, lastly, some news about state transportation. What's new this week?
Right. Wisconsin's Department of Transportation Commission met this week to talk about future projects for the state. These are things that they would like to see added to the state's agenda for road building and expansion. This week, it added three new road projects to a list of construction priorities to consider. And they also decided to look again at a road project in La Crosse that's been stalled for years. So what they added was, in southeast Wisconsin, rebuilding and widening a section of Interstate 43 north of Milwaukee from Glendale to Grafton. They're going to expand that to three lanes in each direction and also rebuild a lot of on-ramps and bridges. A segment of Interstate 94 in western Wisconsin, St. Croix County, and part of State Highway 50 in Kenosha County.
Of course, building roads costs money.
A lot of money.
What do we know about how much these potential projects could cost?
Well, the estimate right now is $600 million, for more than $600 million. And there's no plan in place to pay for that if they're approved. These still need the governor's approval and the legislature's approval. The governor, by the way, is on this Transportation Projects Commission. And this already comes at a time where the Department of Transportation is asking for new taxes and fees amounting to more than $700 million in the next budget cycle. And that's money that does not take into account these three new projects. So a lot of, the Department of Transportation is already saying it needs a lot more money than it has. And these projects would even, add to that significantly.
And in terms of any other projects out there that are still waiting a final word, what's out there?
Yeah, interesting story from Maureen McCollum in La Crosse this week. There has been an idea, a project sort of in the works for more than 10 years now. It would connect La Crosse to its northern suburbs, so it would build a road north of the city. The DOT actually put aside some money for that project back in the 1990s, and then voters turned it down in a referendum. They said they didn't like the fact that the road would have been built through a section of the La Crosse River Marsh. So the state now is planning to hire a consultant next year to study the whole project and maybe look at some alternatives to it, including how to improve connections between La Crosse and the expanding suburbs using existing roads. So something's going to happen eventually, but it's going to be a while they consider what that might be.
Great. Well, Michael, thanks a lot and have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.